Okay, shall we? So the claim is that the one-many model was already hinting at this idea of force and its expression, that the one is force proper, and it expresses itself in many, and that what we're heading toward, but it takes a while to get there, is what I call a fully two-tier model of the object, where there's an inner essence, which is the truth, and a set of external appearances. And how we get there, and it turns out it takes a while to get from force and expression to a full two-tier model, but that's where we're going. And to say that is to say that the notion of force as essence is really talking about real essences. And that's why he uses the phrase unconditioned universal, suddenly, that he's beginning to show how there's a commitment to asking the question, what is the essence of the object? What is the truth of the object? So the object and its truth are not the same thing. That was already implicit in the deception problem within perception, right? What's the truth of it? And, of course, Locke will do that in terms of primary and secondary qualities. But that's also to say that what's beginning to appear is the thought that thinghood of the thing itself is something inner of some sensible multiplicity, and to say that is to say that perception, with all its naivete, was already on the way to doing natural science, because it was asking questions about what truly belongs to the thing. And once you start asking about what's the inner nature of the thing, what truly belongs to it, how does what truly belongs to the thing relate to how it appears, then you're suddenly, and this is what's going to happen at a crucial moment in the next chapter, for the first time, not only do we have deception, but we're going to get a structural account of the difference between appearance and reality. And we know that that's ancient, right? The thought that appearances and truth are not the same thing, but we haven't yet got to the necessity of that, but that's already hibernating with the one-many talk. And that the two-tier account is as old as Western civilization. Even before Plato, there were unexplained explainers, usually called God. God is just a scientific hypothesis at this level to explain the changes, to explain what's happening, right? You posit some inner truth that's going on there. So the governing phenomenological thought here is that this is just the way things are for the understanding. That the two-tier model is not the result of some crazy scientific hypothesizing about unseen realities. Rather, it is simply one of the ways in which human beings become aware and make sense to themselves of how the world works. So science is a natural outgrowth of common sense, not a wild moving off into a new domain. And therefore, that when Newton says, I make no hypotheses, hypotheses non fingo, for those who prefer Latin, he backs this up with his fourth rule of philosophizing. The fourth rule from Principia, page 796, or for those who are in high church, Principia. In experimental philosophy, this is Newton, propositions gathered from phenomena by induction should be considered either exactly or very nearly true, notwithstanding any contrary hypotheses, until yet other phenomena make such propositions either more exact or liable to exceptions. And Newton has his account of light using just these empirical methods. Westphal, in his edited book, gives a nice account of Newton on this. So his point was is that Newton thought he wasn't doing any kind of deductions. He wasn't a rationalist. He wasn't thinking about how the world must be because the mind thinks it must be that way. Newton really thought that what he was doing was discovering what was there based on induction. Why call this section understanding as opposed to perception? What is the extra bit here? We now have a new concept of an object, and now we're looking at the form of knowing that goes along with it. So it's a match between, so force and understanding, right, is to tell you what the concept of an object is, force, and the kind of knowing appropriate to understanding forces. Why is understanding rather than perceiving what's going on here? And the answer to this is that we say we need to understand something is to claim that we have a question about why with respect to it. So when we can answer the why question, why did that happen? We say, oh, now I understand. So understanding is arriving at a view of things that require explanation. So everything in this chapter is going to be a movement of discovering why things are thus and so. Not that they are thus and so. That was what perception did. We're doing something new now. We're asking why they are thus and so. Why they have these characteristics and not others. Why, the simplest of all, I'm going to give you an account of it. Why matter resists. Right? So saying that things are thus and so because or in light of whatever is to give an explanation. So we are now at a way of thinking about the world. We are not just perceiving the world, but also beginning to comprehend it, but comprehend it not through, but a very modest notion of comprehension, namely one in which the very nature of the structure of force raises questions that can be understood and answered through experience. So the claim is still we're at the level of experience. Nonetheless, the real work of understanding we're going to discover is explaining things. That's where the chapter is going to end, with the notion of explanation and infinity. And once we arrive at explanation as what is required, we will also come to the insight that explanation is not a natural relation between different sectors of nature. So one natural way of talking about explanation is event A explains event B. So you may think explanation is just a natural relation, say cause and effect. Right? What we're going to discover is that the very notion of explanation, and thinking that way is holding on to representation. That explanation is not something we do, but something we observe. And what we get to by the end of the chapter is that we discover that explanation is a wholly human social practice, a human way of making sense of the world, and not only a human way of making sense of the world, but a human way of making sense of a world that will provide, and I use this word with great emphasis, italics, exclamation points, not just we want just not an explanation, we want a satisfying explanation, one that satisfies our explanatory desires. So the discovery of that the world must be understood in such and such terms, as a law-given, predictive, etc., totality, is meant to generate a satisfying account of the world. And once we're into asking about satisfaction of an explanatory scheme, we've stopped talking about how the world is and started thinking about how we think about the world. Material. So what kind of a failure are we going to be looking for in thinking about force and understanding? What is the sort of failure appropriate to this level of consciousness? In sense certainty, and so why am I doing this? Because I want to underline that every form of consciousness generates a new notion of failure. So the fact that the form of consciousness, the concept of an object, and the form of knowing don't match up is not a failure of correspondence in the literal sense of it. Every failure is different. As Beckett says, we learn to fail better. Right? We fail differently all the time. So in sense certainty, right, the failure occurred because consciousness could not achieve the determinacy that it stipulated, right? It failed determinacy. Perception has determinacy. That's not its problem. Perception fails because it could not hold together the two components of its concept of an object. Right? So it was a much more metaphysical failure. It said the object is a thing with properties, but it couldn't figure out what on earth a thing with properties was. Right? That kept breaking apart So it couldn't, there was nothing for it to perceive because the very object of perception kept disappearing. Now, I suggest that the most important thing to notice about the one, the bare substratum, is that it was not itself a perceptual item, but a kind of posit or presupposition necessary to hold the many properties together. Famously, what does Locke say about substance holding up the properties? It is a
And then what he's...
Je ne sais quoi. And I know not what. And Kant has a word for the I know not what. He calls it the transcendental object equals X. Which is his reading of, and I'm going to get to this in a second, of Locke's underlying substance. So you're right, it was a substratum and he doesn't know what it is. It's an I know not what. I like the French translation. So Hegel's phenomenologically introducing the idea that for us to have a determinate cognitive awareness of an object or event, there must be some feature of the situation, namely its oneness, that makes it a determinate one that is not itself perceptual or sensible. And hence that the necessary condition for the possibility of object awareness is that there may be a non-sensible one collecting or holding together the sensible many. And it's this very claim about the one and the many that is Kant's Copernican turn in A109. So what A109 does, and the only person who's seen this, there's an essay of Henry Allison from that 1970 who kind of got this right. Then he doesn't, never repeated it. Because I don't think he came to hate the A deduction. But the crux of the Copernican turn is that it's not about you, it's about Locke and the I know not what. And the Copernican turn happens in this very two paragraphs of A109. And I want to read it because it's going to come back over and over again about what's going on here. So Kant says, now also we are in a position to determine more adequately our concept of an object in general. Oh, concept of an object in general, how nice. All representations have as representations their object and can themselves in turn become objects of other representations. So what is it to be a representation? It's to represent something else. That's what it is to be a representation. So every representation has an object. And by the way, he's talking here in wholly Lockean terms until a certain moment. We'll flip. So you can think of all this as in Lockean terms. Appearances are the sole objects that can be given to us immediately, and that in them, which relates immediately to the object, is called intuition. So things appear, they affect us. We call that having an intuition of the object. And he says, these appearances are not things in themselves. No, they are what appear, right? They are only representations, which in turn have their object. An object which cannot itself be intuited. Why can't it be intuited?
An appearance.
Yeah, it has to appear, right? The only way to think is to... So we're stuck with representations. which is what all of consciousness is about. And Kant is just driving home that thought. The reason we can't have immediate knowledge of things in themselves is because the thing has to appear to us through our sensory apparatus. Right? And that's a representation. That's what an appearance is. It's a representation of a thing that affects us. But if it's a representation, it's a representation of something. Right? That's what it is. Otherwise, it's not a representation of anything. It's just a phantasmagoria. So we take it that it's a representation of something. An object which cannot self be intuited by us, and which may therefore be named the non-empirical, that is, transcendental object equals X. And I say that's what is simply Lockean substance, the I know not what. Now comes the Copernican turn. And you just have to watch it happen. So remember, we're talking about these representations have an object. And what's the role of the object, anyone? You just read perception.
To hold together the properties.
Right. It's the one that is the ground of the unity of the properties. And Kant's going to say that directly. Right? He's going to say the pure concept of this transcendental object, which in reality, throughout all our knowledge, is always one and the same, is what can alone confer upon all our empirical concepts in general relation to an object, that is objective reality. This concept cannot contain any determinate intuition and therefore refers only to that unity which must be met with in any manifold of knowledge which stands in relation to an object. And then what's the next sentence? What is it? Anyone? The next sentence?
Unity of consciousness.
It's just a unity of consciousness. That's what gives a relationship to the object. It's not the one that holds the property together. Right? And that's the Copernican turn. From the I know not what to the relationship of the object being established by consciousness, not by hypothesizing. That's pretty much what's going to happen in Force and Understanding. It's going to travel this path of these 8-10 sentences, whatever. So consciousness and Force and Understanding is searching for the transcendental object equals X. That's what it's doing. Not yet moving from substance, it's not doing the Copernican turn yet, but rather positing this or that way to satisfy the need for unifying ground, because the very way in which the one and the many kept falling apart in perception comes to require consciousness to adopt, as I suggested, a truly two-tiered account of the object, in which the unity of the object is to be derived from a non-sensible ground, or unconditioned universal. So the general movement of the chapter on Force of Understanding is the exploration, as Pippin rightly says, of various non-ideal candidates for the non-sensible unity of experience. Let me repeat that sentence. We're searching for various non-ideal, that is not mental, not from me, not subjectively imputed, non-ideal candidates for the non-sensible, nonetheless non-sensible, unity of experience. So this is, what do I want to say? This whole chapter is the gap between one paragraph and the next in Kant. the attempt to say, no, 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 there's a non-ideal, there is a transcendental object x equals x, and I know what it is. Not that I know not what, I know what it is. And we're going to get the very answer. It's going to be called inner, it's going to be called real essence, it's going to be called force proper, it's going to be called the unconditioned universal, it's going to be called the supersensible, it's going to be called appearances as appearances, it's going to be called the unchanging, it's going to be called law, it's going to be called lawfulness, it's even going to be called universal gravitation. Does anyone remember what Locke says about universal gravitation? Well, you guys don't read Locke, do you? I think we need a Locke course here. So he only brings up, as far as I can make out, I remember in the essay, he only brings up universal gravitation once. And he says, gravitation is what holds the world together. We have no idea what it is. He has no idea what it is because it's relational. And his empiricism will not allow for truly relational properties. We'll get there. Okay, let's begin. That was all framing the chapter. So we know what we know where the chapter is going. That was the idea. We know why it's going there. We know what the stakes are. So it should be easy to track it down. That was the idea of giving an introduction. So toward the end, paragraph 136, Hegel states, in general, it is clear that this movement is nothing but the movement of perception. So he's done all this crazy stuff, and he says, it's clear, this is just perception all over again. So this statement should not be interpreted by saying that the introduction of force accomplishes nothing. Hegel actually means the converse. What he's arguing here, right at the very beginning, is that the tension between the notion of force proper and the expression of force, where the expression of force is the new notion of the many, that in thinking this through, what we're doing is making explicit what was already implicit in all the to-ing and fro-ing between unity and manifold in perception. That is, the whole of the first phase of force and understanding is going to play itself out as variations on exactly the same themes as perception. And it's going to do so because understanding wants to preserve the commitments of perception, including a non-relational conception of essence. In itself. So it's an in itself that expresses itself, but that's the nature of it. Right? Bernstein's model, right? So at the beginning, force proper is always an exclusive one, and therefore it is force itself that posits its matters, which cannot exhaust it, because it is an in itself, and these are just its expression. Of course, using the word posit here is kind of crazy, because he says, you know, force posits it, and then withdraws into itself. As if, and someone mentioned this, as if it was an agent. But it's important when you begin thinking about force you already begin thinking in agential terms or animistic terms, because force is bringing up something else that we haven't talked about much. So far, we've dealt with a completely static world without any change, except time. Time change and sense certainty. But things don't seem to change, right? But no, things change all the time. And we have to account for both change and movement. And once we have movement, then the great debate, right from the beginning of time... In the beginning of time, it was clear to everyone that everything that moved was alive. And we tracked back on that thought and came to the other view, namely that movement is just causal affection. So we have two competing notions of force and movement, the movement of an agent and the movement of things in causal relations. But movement is essential. Motility is essential to thinking about the world. And that's being introduced here. So the first shot at all of this is that if it is in the nature of force to express itself, and the preservation of force proper in relationship to its expression requires that that expression is the result of something outside the object. Why express itself? Why doesn't it just stay in itself? It expresses itself because something else is there that it has to exclude or relate to. Therefore, its expression, Hegel says, is solicited by another. That's all he means now, is that the very notion of expression only makes sense if there's another around to whom those various things could make a difference, namely separating them. And you should now think of this soliciting force as having the same role here that perceptual consciousness had in perception, right? Because in perception, in order to deal with the tension between the one and the many, we said, oh, well, I'm the reason for the many. It has to appear that way to me. So what happens in this place is, instead of me being the reason, it's just another object. But in the same way, the other object is meant to require that the object express itself in this way. And that's a terrible argument. And it's a terrible argument for the obvious reason that if the only reason I express myself is because you solicited me, well, why did you solicit me? In other words, the only reason you solicited me is because I solicited you. And now we've got a contradiction. So the soliciting won't work, right? Because it collapses, it makes me into the passive person rather than the in itself. So if each thing is in itself and agent, then there's no way of breaking those two apart. So that move doesn't work. And hence, that's the entire logic of soliciting and being solicited collapses into itself, which is what Hegel says in the last sentence of paragraph 138. Last paragraph. But since the second force is essentially an alteration of those two moments, it is itself force, it is likewise the universal medium, only through its being solicited to be such. And similarly to, it is a negative unity, it solicits the retraction of force into itself, only through its being solicited to do so. Because understanding is, what's happening here is, again, let me be clear what's happening and why. It's because the understanding wants essence to be non-relational. It wants it to be a truth in itself, not because of another, but because of what it is. It's who I am. That's why I express myself, not because of you. Yeah?
Because if it didn't have that commitment, then that's not a problem for them to solicit each other.
That's right. Then they just, and that comes about later. That's what he calls the play of.
Yeah, so this is already premeditating what, as he was always.
Right. Yep.
Sneaky
stuff. Yeah. He gets you where he wants to take you, eh? So because the understanding is refusing relational analysis of essence, it further pivots in paragraph 139. The final sentence of that says, it's one of those endless sentences, alas, the external soliciting force appears as a universal medium, but only through its having been solicited by the other force to do so. But this means that the latter gives it that character and is really itself essentially a universal medium. It gives the soliciting force this character just because the other determination is essential to it, i.e., because this is really its own self. Notice all the self-talk. All this, why? What's going on here? The thought here is, so what he's claiming here is this. That you solicit me because I posit you as soliciting me. And that's very clever, because it's saying, look, if my essence is to be express myself by being solicited, then if I'm going to have my own internal essence, then even I have to posit the other as what solicits me as keeping my essentiality. Which is kind of all, so this preserving of the moment of unity and essentiality against expression occurs because expression essentially dilutes and disperses essence. Even though expression from the opposing angle is the truth of essence, or becomes of it. So understanding stumbles at the gate, repeating variations on perceptions one and many. And if we ask ourselves how we might get past this dilemma, then the first natural response is to say that what makes a particular force the force it is, the answer we're going to give, remembering perception, is it's what will naturally give rise to exactly these appearances. So what's the truth of force? That it appears like this. So rather than going in itself as the truth, it's going to go in the other direction and say the truth of force is its appearances. So the empirical upshot of positing particular forces is simply that we have the appearances we do. And this is, of course, is the standard empiricist an instrumentalist critique of the realist postulation of forces or powers or entelechies. Right? If you're empiricist, people say, well, what do you mean there's a force underlying, you know, so the famous one is, you know, opium has the force to put you to sleep. What do you mean other than when you take opium, you fall asleep? What's the secret force power there? Mysticism, forget it. Just stay with the appearances. So we get rid of, so that's just like saying, right, the many properties of the truth. It is saying that. So in contrast to this, the empiricist is therefore going to argue that since the content of force theories really is just the appearances, then scientific theories and laws are really just inductive summations of previous experience that permit reasonable prediction. Hence, to know that B regularly follows A is to know why B occurred, right? Because A occurred. And what is unsatisfactory with this is that it merely re-describes what happened without providing an answer to the question why. Right? That's the problem with inductive explanations of causal happenings, right? This doesn't explain anything. It just says, that's what happens. Always. Where the always, Hume says, is the imagination kicking it up a level. So, faced with the emptiness of inductive empiricism, what we are offered is increasingly complicated accounts of the underlying forces. Forces soliciting and being solicited by one another. And apart from the details here, the arguments here are just going to be a repetition of what we have already seen. Namely, the upshot of all these forces is simply going to be the appearances again. So paragraph 141, he says, what they are only in this middle term and in this contact. What they are, what forces are in the middle term. Why middle term, anyone? Middle term between what and what?
Between force proper and I.
Exactly. The appearances are a middle term that connect the inner of things with me. And the middle term, they're saying, is just doing all the work. However, in this same paragraph 141, towards the end of it, Hegel says something quite extraordinary. He says, thus, the truth of force remains only the thought of it. Thus, the truth of force remains only the thought of it, the moments of its actuality, their substances and their movement collapse unresistingly into an undifferentiated unity, a unity which is not force driven back into itself, for this is itself only such a moment, but it is the notion qua notion, the concept qua concept. How did we get there? How did suddenly the concept qua concept arise in the middle of all of this? Okay, let me do a little reconstruction. At the beginning of paragraph 141, so clearly the paragraph 141 is going to set off. Now, look, the concept qua concept is the end of the logic. So to have that would be to have everything.
And we're nowhere near that. But the concept is Hegel's idea of the ground of unity, right? Which we don't know even what that is, but he's hinting at something big and important going on here. Of which the transcendental union of apperception is a version. That's the concept qua concept. Okay, paragraph 141, how do we get there? And what's Hegel doing here? So paragraph 141 begins this way. What results from all of this is that the concept of force becomes actual by virtue of its being doubled into two forces. And it emerges just how it comes to be actual. These two forces exist as essences existing in themselves, but their existence lies in the kind of movement of each against the other, so that their being is even more a pure being posited through another, which is to say that the pure meaning of their being is even more that of vanishing. I assume you beat your head against the wall quite a bit when you read that. So let me see if I can unpack it a little. There's a lot going on even there. So let's ask the question, why must there be at least two forces? First of all, to say this is to say that the notion of force defies and repudiates the logic of the thing that it was brought in to explicate. Namely, a non-relational intrinsic in itself, thus. Say there must be two forces is a remarkable thing. If the world were composed of atoms, there could be just one atom. Nothing wrong with that. And what does Newton say in the optics? What Newton said in the optics was, and God created the world, and he composed it of such small, hard corpuscles that they could not be broken apart. So God composed the world of little atoms. So hard, it couldn't be separated. And that hardness was very important. So it's logically possible that there could be a world with just one atom. And atomism, I should say, I take this as obvious. If the world were composed of atoms, then the state of the world at any one time would tell you nothing about its past or its future. Because an atom is complete and self-sufficient at each moment. It's not going anywhere. It is what it is. So if atoms were the truth of the world, then the world would be intrinsically static but set in motion, which is again what Newton says, and then it keeps going by inertia. Hegel is now saying that once you begin to think about forces, you require two. This is a huge deal. This means that the world is not composed of atoms. Force goes beyond atomism and therefore entails a non-corpuscular theory of matter. And moving beyond atomism to some form of
primacy of relations is essential to Hegel's thinking here. Now, that said, I take it that this moment there must be two forces is meant to be a commentary or a statement or reflection of proposition 6 of Kant's Metaphysical Foundations of Natural Science. So although not well known, Kant in the Metaphysical Foundations of Natural Science generated a non-corpuscular theory of matter, a force theory of matter. And the only other person who was working at the same time who did something similar was a Polish natural scientist, philosopher named Boscovich, whose first name I forgot. Boscovich, yeah.
So how much is Hegel conceding here to Kant about, let's say, the category of understanding that is causality?
Say what you want by conceding.
Well,
it sounds like it's a nasty thing people shouldn't do to concede anything.
No, I mean, I like to read Hegel as being influenced by Kant. But so to say that everything returns to the understanding and that this, what we want to think of the in itself, is the laws of the understanding. And his conception of force, and specifically about movement, seems to be saying that causality does not exist in this kind of metaphysically robust way, but it's simply a category that we apply to phenomena, which is, I mean, I'm assuming it's, I read it to be an uncontroversial appropriation of Kant's deduction.
Yes. So the answer is, to that extent, that category, so remember, so the answer is yes, and remember that part of the deal of the relationship to Kant was not that he was wrong to have categories, but he was wrong, A, not to have a deduction of the categories, that is where they came from, and Hegel thinks it's history, and B, to think that there were still things in themselves. So Hegel is not flustered by the idea of... So Hegel's concept is a bastard third cousin of the transcendental unity of apperception. And he says so at the end of the logic explicitly.
So I could see that working for certain concepts of the understanding, like freedom, for example, is being realized.
Right.
I don't see how the concept or of causality could be derived historically. I mean, it seems in some way it'd have to be an a priori presupposition for him. Because even every kind of reasonable philosophical account needs some kind of causality.
I just gave you a counterexample of animism. Causality is a particular view of counting for force. And we've seen force. So the story is that none of these are a priori or stored in that sense. That they are, although the phenomenology is not itself a history, it is to say that there's a reason why certain concepts emerge as irresistible. And what we're tracking is the emergence of them as the determinate negation of failed earlier views. So we've got force emerging as implicit in our logic of the thing. We need something like cohesion of the properties and unity and movement, all sorts of things are going on where force looks like. And where we get the notion of force from? Certainly we got it from ourselves. We're movers and agents. And then we certainly project it on the world, but that won't give us
Now we get something more sophisticated. That one gives a force theory of matter. So he's, Hegel is Hegel doesn't think these things are stored in our head in the beginning of time. That categories are not innate ideas. That categories are a result. As I already said, if to be now is a result, then everything's got to be a result. What the original furniture is irrelevant until we have an account of how we find it necessary. And the finding we find it necessary is going to be some historical story. Unless you're a Kantian, right? Then you're going to say, oh, no, you presuppose. No.
One worry that I have, but it's
go ahead.
Tangential. Is it possible for any possible world of human history for us not to come up with the concept of causality? And I don't, for Hegel, I think the answer would be no, because it's struck the imminent development of consciousness. But you might want to say yes.
I want to say that human beings will have accounts of movers. But they may not have an account of causality is an hypothesis that movement requires an explanation. And until you're struck by that or feel the need for that, right? So in the Adorno Horkheimer story, that arises in a moment of terror. Right? Why is all this happening to me? Now I need a cause. I need to begin. And what's my original cause? It's not cause, it's a story. I tell a narrative. So you can say, oh, well, maybe narratives. I don't know about what's original. I think it's a bad thought. Right? That Kant thought he could do it through the deduction. If you're skeptical about possibility, if you think the deduction works, right? Then you'll be less impressed by this. So what I want to say is we are self-moving and aware of movement, and therefore simulate things on our agency pretty early on, animism. But do we have the Kantian concept of cause?
Does Beatrice Longinus' version of the deduction move him towards Hegel in this way? Or does it poke holes in the way we're thinking about Kant as having a priori categories?
It's more the latter she's interested in.
Oh.
Because she thinks there are ways in which right. Okay, so let me tell Kant's story, so at least we get past paragraph 141. So proposition 6 reads that by mere attraction, maybe gravity, without repulsion, no matter is possible. That's the thesis. By mere attraction, without repulsion, no matter is possible. And Kant says, now I'm quoting, attractive force is the moving force of matter whereby it compels another to approach. Consequently, when such forces found among all parts of matter, then it endeavors by means of this force to diminish the distance of its parts from one another and hence the space they together occupy. What follows from that? Attraction is decreasing the space. Which way?
There has to be repulsion.
Yeah, if all there was attraction is the world would reduce to one point. So, so, the force that is opposed to attraction is a repulsive force, and he denies that there can be infinite forces. Therefore, by mere approach and without repulsive forces, all parts of matter would approach one another without hindrance. Hence, but once you have two forces, then you have the conditions for resistance. So that's why it turned into a theory of matter. Now, Hegel's analysis simply underlines Kant's conclusion here that these two, attractive and repulsive, positive and negative, whatever, belong inseparably to the concept of matter. Therefore, there must be a minimum of two forces. Now return to paragraph 141. The essence rather consists simply and solely in this, that each is solely through the other, and what each thus is, it immediately is no longer, since it is the other. They have thus, in fact, no substance of their own, which might support or maintain them. And that's when Hegel then leads to the thought that force is merely the thought of force. What does Hegel argue with here? Well, we know that Kant was attempting was an a priori account of the constitution of matter. Right? Given causality, he says, give me, you know, movement. Movement is not a priori. That's the empirical extra. Then he says, I can give you a deduction of matter. Hegel's point is that the metaphysical oomph, which is supposed to allow force to be both a kind of ontological glue that holds the world together and provides for the hardness of matter, its character of resistance, is nothing but a reflective construction. I just gave you the construction, and you beautifully saw the thought immediately. There's just one thing, right? It's either, you know, an atom, nothing, or one force disappears altogether. What the understanding is doing is something like Kant's a priori construction. It's trying to make the world intelligible by showing that there must be forces of such and such kind in order for the world to be possible. And then, and here's the difference, in force and understanding, although we've just said this is a construction, it's a conceptual idea, what understanding wants is this. No, this is to be the world. Nothing to do with me making the world intelligible to myself. Nothing about the concept qua concept. No, this is just the way things are. Hypothesis non-finger. It's description. So because understanding is metaphysically inclined and remains realist to the very end of this chapter and never gets beyond it, well, that's a big deal, understanding never becomes self-conscious. We do. It doesn't. Very interesting. Get there next week. But that's because it ignores this lesson and interprets the result in the following way. What we have before us is a play of forces without substance. As a consequence, substance must lie elsewhere, which is how the understanding, and now this is the crucial transition here, how the understanding finally breaks from the logic of perception and becomes a separate form of consciousness. It's here in the movement from 141 to 142. Because now,
it introduces a truly two-tier model that has been ticking away from the very moment the notion of one bare substratum was introduced. So Hegel concludes paragraph 142. I should say, let me give you a trick to reading Hegel. Look really hard at the first and last sentences of every paragraph. He projects and he summarizes. And you can get lost sometimes, but if you check at the beginning and ends, often that will be helpful. So, he concludes paragraph 142 this way. The former, the first universal, would be the force driven back into itself. That is, the force as substance. However, the second universal is the inner of things as inner, which is the same as the concept as concept. Of course, understanding will not construe the inner nature of things as the concept as concept, but rather as the true metaphysical reality. And that's what he states in paragraph 143. The genuine essence of things now has been determined as not existing immediately for consciousness. Underline that 17 times. Finally, consciousness is saying that what initially appears to me is not the inner essence. But look, this is how this whole thing started. Consciousness wants a representational account, and its first gambit was that this representational account was things as they appear to me. And for the first time, consciousness, because of the problem of forces, has been forced to acknowledge that what appears to me is not an inner truth. Rather, consciousness has an immediate relationship to the inner, and as the understanding, it looks into the true background of things by means of this middle term of the play of forces. So now the play of forces is itself the appearances. That's what we see, a play of forces. And the middle term, which merges together the two extremes, that is the understanding and the inner, is the developed being of force, which for the understanding is henceforth a vanishing. So the vanishing is not mysterious now. The play of forces is a vanishing because it's not the truth. It vanishes into its truth, which is the essence which we're trying to look into and discover as the inner truth of these vanishing moments. Call it change and non-change. That helps. For that reason, it is called appearance. Look, it's a play of the world. And it's not the truth of the world. So for the first time, instead of talking about reality, we have a distinction between appearance and reality. And we have to make that. We've been forced to make that distinction. Not by hallucinations, not by silly counterexamples, brains in a vat. We've been forced to distinguish appearance and reality out of our own attempt to make sense that we see a world full of things. And we can't make sense of how a thing is held together as one, so we are positing there's some inner nature of what's holding that thing together. And therefore, we have to think of what appears to us as mere appearance, as not the truth, and not the essence. And of course, we've been heading this way all along. Listen explicit again. Why? Because we've been forced at various moments to talk about what is essential and what is unessential. Appearance and reality is just a further articulation of that language that, no, the one is essential. Right? We've just stabilized that now into a beginning to think about the fact that we have to distinguish between appearance and reality. However, it is not merely a seeming to be, but rather an appearance, a whole of seeming to be. The whole as a whole, that is a universal, is what constitutes the inner, the play of forces, as the play's reflective turn into itself. The inner is, in the eyes of consciousness, undeniably the concept, but consciousness is not yet acquainted with the nature of the concept. That is, I mean, he's really forecasting here, right? So, if I have to think about the inner nature of things, right, then I am going to have to consider what will count for me as a satisfactory account of what will account for the whole of this play of forces. So the inner nature of things is the truth of the world. That's what he said. The play of forces is everything. It's the whole world in all its movements. And the inner nature, he says, is the concept. That is how we make intelligible to ourselves that unity of all of that. But we're not there yet. No, what are we going to do? If we're the understanding, we're going to say, I've got an idea what's back there. So rather than taking responsibility and thinking about it's going to posit some inner kernel. It's going to say that there's some fact of the matter, a real thing, that is the explanation of all of this. So all of this is pressing the understanding into more desperate attempts to generate, remember what we're talking about, to generate a non-sensible, non-ideal condition that can plausibly ground the appearances without skeptical remainder. Which is what I said we were going to do, right? A non-ideal, but non-sensible. Why non-sensible? Because sensible is now the appearances. The whole sensible world is nothing but appearances. And we have to explain it. So the extra gesture at this juncture is that the understanding now recognizes that the non-sensible condition must be really supersensuous. It's now committed itself. So I said, look, you had the supersensuous right there with the bare substratum. You just didn't know you did. Right? You thought there was a thing, a one. Right? So now, at a certain moment, in a logic, and this is important, we come to view the intelligibility of the world as not exhausted by its appearances, and we think there must be something inner behind the appearances that is explaining, moving, collecting, organizing, right? And as I say, early on we're going to talk about gods and origins of the world and all of that. And scientifically we're going to do something else. But the claim is, and we're going to move, the big movement we're going to make, and we'll do it next week, one answer is law. Law is the non-sensuous truth
of. Now, when we talk about law here, we're not talking about laws as things people create. We're talking about laws as real. Right? As I mentioned outside, you know, there's the famous MIT graffiti. Yeah. And on the first day, God said, E equals MC squared. That is, this is what Galileo thought, right? That mass was not a human projection onto nature. It was the structure of nature itself. Law is the things themselves in their regularity and order, which is what Plato thought. Plato thinks the ideas are real. He thinks they're the real, super sensuous truth of the sensible world. Plato was just an early scientist. Just and much of the logic of this chapter, including the role of law and one, is Platonic. Rationalist science and Platonism have the same logic. What makes it rationalist is the belief, not that these things are constructions or human inventions. We discover them. They're real. So not only do we have an appearance and reality distinction, but we now have, just from our beginnings with, here's an apple, we now have a commitment to law as the truth of the world. We will stop there. We will complete Force and Understanding next week and do the transition. I would like to get to the transition, just the transition in the opening section of self-consciousness, all that weird stuff on life. Don't worry about this section. It really is here.
Even this